Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champions. Today in our studio, we've got Charles Carey. Charles is a seasoned banker. He's had an illustrious career from his youthful days in Hong Kong all the way to Nairobi, where he's currently based, and a number of African markets where he's built distinctive organizations in the banking industry. Charles, it's great to have you on our podcast. Thank you for making the time and tell us a little bit about yourself.
So it's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me. As you said, it's been probably more industrious more than illustrious, but it's certainly been in the last few decades, it's been great fun. I think the Africa Renaissance cycles have been, backwards and forwards. And I think we're strongly onto another one. You look at the commodity prices around the world picking up. And if I look at, some of the economies I've worked in, very dependent on strong commodity prices, then we believe that we're in a new phase of growth for this colourful continent.
Fantastic. So very timely period for us to have this conversation. I just want to dial back for a moment, Charles, for those who don't know you, tell us a little bit about your earlier experiences and what made you move to Africa, fall in love with the continent and do some distinctive things here.
I was born in UK many, many decades ago and kind of grew up in Hong Kong with boarding school sort of background and commuted between Hong Kong and UK for all my sort of schooling years. Then went to university in UK before university, spent a year just under about 10 months traveling around Africa. And it was very much a sort of a spin the globe and stick my finger somewhere. And I'd, been, because of my living in Hong Kong, I'd traveled extensively around Asia and obviously Europe, but hadn't been to Africa. My mum had spent about a year in Kenya, obviously several decades before that. And I said, well, maybe I'll go to Africa. And so I did. I was in Paris. I jumped on a plane, arrived in Dakar, Senegal, and then started a 9-10 month journey from Senegal across to Kenya and down to Zimbabwe. And I just thought, this is an extraordinary, extraordinary place. Amazing diversity of cultures, of geography, huge diversity, which I just absolutely fell in love with. And it was a bit of a cliche, but it was total sort of transformation of what my perspectives were. And then I was lucky enough to meet a girl who was from Kenya, who's now my wife. So that sort of reinforced the opportunity for me, as well as cementing my sort of passion for Africa. So I kind of had always, from age 18, just had a sort of desire to sort of spend more time out here. And in fact, joined Citibank very much for its footprint across the continent and generally sort of emerging markets. But that was something which I felt was aligned to what I was trying to do. So my plan was to sort of leverage that and join, come to Africa on the back of a Citibank opportunity, which materialized with an offer to South Africa, but just didn't really resonate with me at the time. I was looking for more sort of Eastern African markets. So anyway, I left and joined a regional group in Nairobi, and then set up the operation in Kampala, Uganda, which was an acquisition, a brownfield acquisition, which we grew. And I was then approached after about a year and a half by some ex-Citibankers who I sort of knew from former life. And they were looking to sort of extend their sort of transactional model. And I'd asked if I would join them. And I was quite keen to, but I didn't want to do sort of a road warrior job. I was more concerned about sort of having a little bit more sedentary sort of lifestyle. So I set up their operation in Malawi, which was, again, a totally greenfield proposition. And it was project-based initially, so setting up literally the building and the sort of recruitment and sort of policies and all sorts of other stuff, as well as doing transactional banking. And that was 3.5 years in Malawi, building Lloyds Investment Bank, which was, that was my sort of second sort of bank setup. And I remember thinking after that, there must be easier things to do in life than setting up a new bank, because it's extraordinarily sort of taxing. And you're obviously, whilst you're running a project, you're also trying to build a business. So you're kind of building client base, building transaction, building revenue, throughout. So it's kind of doing multitasking and it's under huge pressure. And then with Loisha, I moved to Zambia. We had a management contract with a large local bank, and I was there for 4.5 years building up that franchise. And then joined Barclays on their sort of Africa Indian Ocean team and seconded to Zambia to run their corporate investment banking operation. And at the time when Barclays was obviously fairly dominant in the sort of Africa markets and was ambitious to extend and grow their positions. So I was part of that sort of growth phase and then was in 2013, joined Capricorn Long Investment Group, which was a Namibian-based listed entity, which had three operations across Namibia, Botswana, and Zambia. And they were looking to try and sort of turn around their asset in Zambia, which was a sort of non-performing financial institution, and during a time that banks were expected to bring a lot more capital in. So they were keen to sort of get some value and yield on that. And so within about a year and a half, we sort of made our first, reported our first sort of profitability, and then we continued to do so for the next 3.5 years. And then I moved on after 5 years with them, over 5 years, and went to Cape Town for personal reasons, for family. We needed to sort out some medical issues. And I was then commuting to Kigali, Rwanda, where, it wasn't planned. It was just one of the things that sort of happens. And I was ended up on as of a advisory position to a local bank in Rwanda, working with their board and the executive team to deliver a transformation in the way the bank was operating and implement a sort of a five-year strategy to sort of grow their share of market and really sort of leverage a position that, that they could as a very strong local brand and, deliver sort of higher value to all the shareholders. Mm. So I did that for basically a year and a half until COVID, and then took a sort of a sabbatical period during COVID in Cape Town, which was quite refreshing and very different, until the end of the year, basically. And I came up to Nairobi, which is a market which I'm familiar with and where my wife's family is still based, and been here since.
So I guess the one question that already pops up is you having had experience both with Greenfield's operations, setting up a bank from scratch, as well as with entities that have already acquired, that we're trying to turn around, that we're trying to improve the performance of. If I had to ask you, what have you seen were the benefits of starting a new banking operation? I know it's rather unusual in many of these markets versus turning around an existing operation. Was there anything that kind of stood out for you in building that distinctiveness of in the organization?
Obviously, very, very different sort of processes, Sarah. I think Greenfield, the opportunity to sort of determine exactly what you want to do and how you want to do it, obviously within the sort of volatility of some of the markets that you're operating in. But, you can choose where, how, what, who with the sort of flavors and that you want to bring to bear. And, you can really determine, you've got a lot more, I guess, strategic autonomy over your program. Whereas if you're sort of taking on, absorbing, merging with, you've got to sort of unwind and reprogram to some extent what you're trying to achieve. So your ability, I guess, to sort of move at the speed that you want in the early days of any merger is somewhat constrained by the sort of partners that you're working with. And that obviously brings its own challenges. But I think, as you said, it's an unusual thing to do now. I think the success factors of mergers are always quite complex, but it's certainly you'd want to, if I was going to do some of those market interventions again, I would go for the sort of brownfields of acquisition, partnership, merger strategy rather than greenfield. I think you're starting from a zero base is a very long, slow burn, which you kind of want to avoid as much as possible. So it may cost you more to enter, but I think you just start off with a base from which you can, at least a platform from which you can move, is going to give you an advantage in the long run.
Yes. I do want to come back to that point, in particularly in today's environment with a much richer ecosystem of both financial and non-financial partners to work with. But just before we go there, just to kind of, I guess, share with our audiences your experience in turning around an organization, and I'm going to ask you to speak a bit more about Capricorn Bank. It's an organization that has been acquired more than once, both by Capricorn and more recently by Access Bank. What was your experience there, and how did you go about making it distinctive?
As you mentioned, I mean, I've forgotten, it has been taken over. In fact, I think it was three times in the history of Cavemont. It sort of evolved from, you know, even before Capricorn got involved, there was another merger in its history. So over the sort of 25 years, it has certainly sort of evolved. But, you know, the reality was it was good at a few things and just not strong enough in others. And I wouldn't say it was bad in anything particular. What it was good at was it had a very good treasury reputation. It was always very on the money on foreign exchange transactions. It had a good reputation, had a fantastic reputation for customer service. And you had I remember being in meetings and engaging with clients, and you know, you'd hear the sort of, oh yeah, but I only do that with Cavemont Bank, or Cavemont always does this. And remember, for example, when I was with Barclays, I'm thinking, but I'm Barclays, you know, who is Cavemont? Why are they dominating this particular part of your wallet when I should be getting 100% share? And so when I joined the team, I spent, you know, a good few days and weeks, and certainly a lot of sort of interactions with both customers as well as the team, just trying to sort of distill exactly what it was that Cavemont had, which was so different to the market, where, you know, customer services was not great at the best of times and dreadful most of the time. So once I'd sort of, you know, almost found the genie and bottled it, I was like, okay, well, this is what makes us different. How do we then ensure that's part of our DNA across the business, and that, you know, every interaction with customers provides this sort of experience. So I was you know, determined to try and sort of, you know, find that sort of that little sweet spot and exploit it. And obviously, you know, it's an intangible, but making sure that on the product side, on treasury, that we built up a team, we built up a pricing mechanism, we built up a sort of, you know, sort of a flow, which enabled us to sort of punch above our weight consistently and start to sort of make inroads into that sort of highly competitive arena in the treasury space. So we, you know, those are things that I focused on, as well as, you know, we had, you know, liquidity issues, we had, you know, credit culture challenges, we had, you know, a lot of, we had high-priced funding, which was, you know, kind of obviously eroding margins. So building the brand, making sure that we were competitive on pricing, making sure that our processes were able to deliver, you know, fast turnaround on credit applications, and also, I think, defining our target. Because of our balance sheet, we were not going to be in a sort of multinational sort of segment. You know, we were going to be a local business player, and local business and consumer players, so SME segment, and make sure that, you know, we were very efficient at delivering product and service to those segments, against which we could perhaps charge a higher premium, but we were delivering better value. So that was the approach I took. And we sort of drew up a 100-day sort of strategy, which I was asked to present to the Capricorn board, and to say, right, these are the things that I need to do, and this is how we're going to go about it, and this is the results I'm anticipating. So we had a sort of, you know, made it a, wasn't just a sort of new chief executive coming in and sort of saying, like, you know, this is what it's going to do, but I sort of, you know, kind of rolled it out very quickly across the whole Cavemont, from, you know, the executive team down through to your, you know, rural branch teller. And we went through exactly how it's going to look, what's going to happen, why we're doing this, what their contribution will mean, and this is what success will look like. And it worked. You know, we dealt with some of the fires that were sort of, you know, simmering, and some which were sort of, you know, full on flames. And we started to, you know, turn the institution around.
It's interesting that you say that, Charles, because one of the things that we've noticed with organizations, which we came to call hidden growth champions, is their ability to recognize their own distinctiveness early in the process. You kind of called it, you found something that you wanted to bottle, okay? And then the speed at which they went about fixing the things that were not part of it. Okay, so in the process, they became much clearer and much simpler in their thinking. It wasn't a case of adding more layers, more complexity, and while we do everything else, we'll add this to it. But it became a very clarifying exercise. It sounds like you went through the same level of clarity, the same kind of challenging process that gets to, in essence, this is what makes us distinctive. and then rolled it out across the bank. So it's a very interesting observation. And just to ask a question, I mean, as you started to see early results, was that a stepping stone to something else? Was there a point where you said, I think we got this right, now we're ready for something else? Or did you find that it was actually quite a long process? It needed a lot of time to settle for people to be able to contribute as you were describing it. What was your experience there?
When you start something, you've obviously got to determine, you know, is this a sprint, middle distance or marathon? And so, you know, there's some quick wins. And I think it's very important to be able to sort of chart those as well as ensure that everyone's aware that this is going to be hard, fast, furious, but there's going to be something at the end of that sort of 100 meter. And this is what it's going to look like. So there were certain things that I did, for example, trying to address our liquidity challenges. You know, it was mission critical. We needed to sort out our sort of funding and make sure that we were kind of able to sort of manage our balance sheet appropriately, get the right sort of pricing on that, and address some of the sort of regulatory issues that we would otherwise be facing. And that was literally sort of going, okay, for the next 90 days, this is what we're going to do, this is how it's going to work, and this is what is required of everybody. So it was pretty intense, but everyone knew that, you know, if we succeeded, that would be such a massive win for us, and it would have a material impact on sustainability, our performance overall, and as well as just, you know, being able to sort of, you know, banking is all about trust and confidence, and make sure that the market, you know, saw us as a very different type of organization. So that was your sort of, you know, sprint 100 meters. Everyone, I used to call it, sort of all hands on deck. You know, from everyone was involved, and we sort of ran it like a campaign, and we got everyone sort of, you know, stoked up about it, sort of, you know, data managed it, made sure that there was sort of daily updates throughout the business. So it was, you know, the sort of the rubber hitting the road fast and furious was for a period of time, which was going to give everyone, I guess, at the end of it, a sort of level of satisfaction and release that, you know, you can kind of, okay, we've achieved. Then there was sort of the middle stuff, which you knew that, this is going to be way beyond the sort of 90 days or 100 days. This is going to be within a 12-month period. But we need to start. We need to start that now in order to deliver. And so, you know, that was a little bit building slightly different sort of structures around what we're trying to do, more projects and team-based. But again, involving, you know, broader audiences to how this is going to work and what was required of everybody. And then you've got your long-term stuff, and that was some of the sort of, you know, initiatives around technology, around sort of branch renovations, around sort of, you know, branch extension, you know, to building new branches and things like that. This is, again, stuff which is, you know, pipeline, need to start doing it there and then, but we knew that it was going to be 12 to 18 month or more initiatives. So you can't keep everyone sprinting for beyond that sort of, you know, 100 meters, because you're just going to get sort of fatigue and exhaustion, and obviously, you know, they're not going to complete the race. So you've got to get your team aligned to their specific targets, goals, objectives around, okay, how long, what's required of them for how long and under how much pressure in order to get the best results. So, you know, we kind of, as I said, we were very clear around where different initiatives, you know, sat in that sort of short, medium and long term. And we built our sort of capacities around being able to sustain the sort of tempo required to deliver certain projects. And, you know, we did. And it was great. We really made a difference around, you know, getting our team involved, getting our liquidity sorted, addressing some of the sort of market concerns and credibility and funding, becoming much more customer centric, getting our sort of communication out around to both internal and external around what we're doing and how we're doing it, sorting out some of our regulatory issues. We made it a sort of almost programmed to sort of, you know, go to the central bank, you know, every couple of, probably about three times a year for the first couple of years, just to sort of make sure that they were very comfortable with what we're doing and how we're doing it, so that we were sort of proactively engaged with them rather than them responding to concerns that they may have. So that we weren't doing anything which they weren't aware of, but they were aware of a lot of things that we were doing and were comfortable with how we were doing it. So they could see that journey, and it just gave them a sense of, I guess, it built up a level of trust around our competency, as well as credibilities around, you know, how we were delivering what we committed to. And then obviously on the investor side, I mean, we were a public listed company and we needed to make sure that, you know, we were, you know, sort of, you know, giving a sort of a turnaround in terms of our performance and how we were, you know, sort of changing the brand and obviously the financial yield. So these were the sort of, you know, key areas that we were looking at. And, you know, as I said, obviously it was a lot of pressure on the local team, but we were supported very well by Namibia, who'd obviously been intrinsically involved in Gabon for a number of years. I think we're very enthusiastic to see a different approach coming through and certainly supportive of the results that we were beginning to see. So I think, like in anything, Sarah, if you can get a couple of quick wins and everyone suddenly, you know, the credibility of what you're trying to achieve suddenly crystallizes, you there's a buy-in you get from the sort of you know, not the laggards, but certainly the sort of second movers is going to be much greater, and you can see things happening and people respond to, you know, success.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess related to this, was there a point in time where you felt that we've turned the corner, there is no turning back, we are on this new trajectory? Was there a point of realization around this? I'm very conscious that good leaders know how to read their environments well. And I just kind of wonder, at what point do you look and say, this could actually work? It's actually happening. We're not actually going back or just testing, but we are well on the journey.
I'm not sure if it's arrogance or confidence, but I felt very early on a sense of the approach that we were taking was yielding the right results from just talking to our customers. Because, you know, that customer surveys are, you know, very informative and you know, evaluating kind of where you are. But in banking, certainly in sort of commercial consumer banking, one of the biggest sort of litmus tests of you know, customer satisfaction is what is your deposit rate? Is it growing or is it flat or is it shrinking? People, you know, customers will borrow from banks irrespective of how much they like them, to some extent. You know, if they're giving you money, you'll put up with their sort of service and product issues, providing the price is acceptable. But where you put your money is very much dependent on the level of trust, confidence, relationships that you have, and obviously to some extent sort of pricing on those deposits. But it's a real indication of where you sit in the market with your customer segment. And ours, you know, again, through a clear engagement plan and, you know, successfully rolled out within a very short period of time, we were seeing a considerable uplift in our deposits, but at the right price. We were no longer having to spend and pay, you know, premium for deposits, which was what was eroding our margin massively, you know, historically. We were getting a better priced deposit growth, which was critical for our sustainability. And that to me was, okay, the market is responding, our customers are growing in confidence, our share is developing, and we are this is what we're kind of doing. So that was early on. I'm saying early on, probably within sort of 30, 60 days, we were seeing that sort of beginning to happen. And it was because we made a decision that, you know, my role was, you know, you're sort of chief executive, but I was chief relationship officer. I just went out, you know, multiple times a day visiting our existing customers who've been with the bank for years and had, you know, warranted our support. And you know, for me, I was like, I wanted to go and meet them and make sure that they knew, you know, most of them knew who I was, but I wanted them to feel comfortable who they were dealing with and just reassure them that we were there, you know, this is our plan and this is how we're doing it, and just to make sure that I was on their speed dial. And, you know, and we did that. We were relentless. We spent, I don't know how many meetings we had, but it was back to back for weeks and months until we met, you know, majority of our customer base, at sort of certainly on the corporate side, and obviously on individual consumer banking as well. But we just made sure that we were in the market and we were engaging, you know, directly with our existing customers. And once, you know, I think once we'd done that, obviously our approach to sort of extend our customer base through acquisition was at least built on a platform of, you know, kind of growth and pricing, which, you know, we were established over the preceding sort of few months.
Mm, no, absolutely. I often find that we sometimes underestimate, we see it on paper, but we underestimate to what degree sometimes we are willing to acquire new customers, not at the right price. So it's a very poignant point, I think, that you make.
One of the things that, you know, I'm sort of data driven, and I'm, you know, I'm always wanting to sort of get my dashboards and, you know, understand where we are. So, you know, my question was to teams like, oh, well, how many customers do we have? And, you know, it really depended on, you know, who answered. I mean, I'd get numbers from, you know, sort of 30, 50, 60, 70, you know, 1,000. And it's not, obviously not huge relative to anything. But there's no specific numbers. I can't, you know, drilling down into exactly, you know, what we had. And it ended up actually, you know, having a very, very different number to what anyone thought. And certainly, you know, what the expectations had been created, but we were a fraction of that, which was obviously a shock, but it was a reality. And therefore, based on that reality, this is what we needed to do. But it's certainly, you know, getting to the truth of the issues and the facts of the matter are essential in terms of being able to sort of, okay, right, where exactly are we? And therefore, where are we developing from and growing from? What is our platform? And I think you've got to get, you know, really clear position in order for you to be able to determine where and how you move. And I think, you know, making sure that you get those answers, you know, straight up. If it's bad news, let's deal with it. But don't sugarcoat stuff, because it doesn't, you know, if you don't get the right data points, your decision making is going to be flawed.
Absolutely. Now you moved on from Kevmont Bank. I kind of wonder when you look with a bit of perspective, with a bit of a distance at these mid-tier banks, and you look at the environment today of accelerated digitization, of greater willingness of regulators to engage in a different conversation, of more openness. I mean, we looked very recently at the awarding of digital bank licenses, for example. It was a very extensive process that they went through, and it's something that's happening in many jurisdictions around the world. How do you see mid-sized banks dealing with this new environment? On the one side, accelerated digitization, access to new technologies, new players, and sometimes very agile non-banking players playing in the ecosystem. And on the other side, different expectations, more demanding customers, more data-driven decision-making that's now more available. Not by special initiatives, but built into the organization. So as the environment has changed quite significantly from those days, how do you see mid-tier banks succeeding in this environment? Are they at risk, or are they perhaps even better positioned to succeed?
I mean, it's $1 million question or more. it's very, very, one of the, I think, the biggest challenges that mid-tier banks face is, you know, what is the level of disruption that's imminent? And how pervasive will it be? You know, at the end of the day, majority of your mid-tier banks and your, you know, sort of SME backbone customers are doing fairly vanilla transactions. And their sort of interface with the bank is pretty simple. It's, you know, deposit, transfer, and withdrawal in different ways, shapes, and forms. And obviously, the sort of the packaging of that is very much dependent on the individual institution and brand. But fundamentally, that's what they do. So it's, and you're seeing it. I mean, you know, being in Kenya, and, you know, obviously the sort of the globally renowned M-Pesa program, and the sort of, you know, 48% of Kenya's 120 billion-dollar GDP is going through M-Pesa. It gives you a sort of understanding of the scope and how M-Pesa is now being incorporated by all the, you know, majority of banks into their own sort of transfer and payment platform. So it's something which the banks have been, I guess, no one is going to capture the same sort of volume and sort of almost monopoly on that in this, certainly in Kenya market, than M-Pesa. I mean, it's just, and actually they've not been able to replicate it in other markets successfully either. But there is going to be threats to how banks operate, particularly in that mid-tier range with your sort of SME customers. You've got to find ways of engaging and adding value. And if it's pure money transactions, then there's, you know, that way of thinking is going to be invalidated over, you know, a very short period of time. You know, customers require more than just being able to transfer money. They, you know, if they're going into debt structures, then that's going to be a level which some of the disruptors are be challenged by, perhaps more from a regulatory perspective than a product perspective. So I see things changing and shifting enormously. And I've had a number of conversations over the last few months with different bankers, in not just the Kenyan market, but across the region. And I think they're all gearing up to sort of, I guess, shore up their shares of, you know, kind of what they do and how they're doing it. But I don't see them really addressing the risks that they face beyond just protecting what they've got. But I see that the numbers are translating out in terms of, you know, how much transaction is going on outside their sort of banking bubble, compared to what it was, you know, previously. And it's growing. And I think that's something which they need to look at. How do they reinvent their proposition or partner with the appropriate technology to deliver what customers require? So I think it's a hugely evolving environment and a major threat to that mid-tier institution.
Mm. It's interesting you say that. You know, when we look at the phenomena of disruption, and we've been working in this space, not just in the financial services industry, but in industries that have recognized for a long period of time of the disruption. If you think of energy, for example, in more recently, even in the retail space, which does dovetail with retail banking to a degree, what we do find is that disruption is impossible to predict. It often takes a different shape, a different form. It often splits and gives rise to new scenarios that you didn't think about at the beginning. And those that simply look at the phenomena and say, we need to defend, we need to shore up, this is a more challenging environment, what we often find is they misread the signals that actually point to disruption rather than to the challenge in the environment. The challenge, in effect, becomes the symptom of a deeper transition that's taking place, a change in the economic model, a change in the relative level of defense that these incumbents have, whether it's with regulators or with other players in the market, and they often get surprised. And that's when we see new players coming up. That's when we see acceleration of smaller firms coming in. So it's very interesting that you say that, because it really alludes to that, almost that critical decision that one needs to make of, are we facing a more challenging environment, or are we truly facing a disruption? And the answer to that question, or the response to it, will be very different. So it is really, really interesting. I don't know if there is any organization that stand out for you in terms of their more dynamic response, their recognition earlier on of the disruption that's taking place. Is there any names that come to mind for you?
Well, I think, you know, in the industry, if I look at Kenyan market, I think you've got a bank like Equity, which has responded. It actually set out to disrupt the sort of traditional sort of institutions that were dominating the Kenyan economy and financial sector. And, you know, they recognize that, again, you know, providing access and pricing it appropriately, creating the sort of simplicity of touch points, and, you know, extending their sort of coverage model was what the market needed. And it's been very, very successful in doing so. And they've also spent a lot of time and a huge investment into developing their technology and, you know, building their data processing capacity to really, you know, to bring fruit to their sort of whole consumer banking initiative. So they are now, they've extended their markets, and they are growing at a very, very rapid pace in terms of, you know, market share, not just in terms of customer base. And that's, to me, I think they've recognized that the traditional sort of high street model with a sort of fairly middle-class approach was just not going to resonate with the, you know, what was required of the industry. So they disrupted, as I said, the sort of, you know, traditional was Barclays and Standard Chartered and Kenya Commercial Bank, and they just broke it down to sort of, you know, this is what the mass market opportunity looks like, and they've made a success out of it. So
I think you know that that's what they've done very well, and I recognize rather they've also the way that they've done it is kind of they've built up a multi-million number client base, which then can translate to the areas of potential disruption that other banks are facing in terms of if it's going to be your telecoms business that's going to threaten you in terms of money transfers or other sort of products. Equity's built up a very compelling base from which they can likewise compete with the telecoms. They're no longer just a bank with a million customers. They've got, I think, about 13 million customers or more. So they can approach the threat with a very different set of criteria and much more aggressively than a lot of the banks that are sort of having to respond and sort of hunker down. And I think that gives them a huge advantage.
Charles, as we get kind of to the end of the discussion, and I know we can spend an entire discussion alone on Equity Bank and some fascinating lessons from it. But if I had to ask you more broadly, having had the privilege to lead the transformation of a bank, to make it distinctive, to find that unique mix that you can put into a bottle and help people make it real in the organization, are there any lessons that you can share with people who think about their own organizations, who are either already becoming innovators, who are already taking on the challenge, who are looking and saying, someone needs to be done here. We keep on just responding to the challenged environment, but not disrupting ourselves. I can see where this may end up. Any lessons or any insights that you could perhaps share with them as essentially they take the decision of stepping up and taking on that mantle?
I think what I've always tried to do is talk to people outside your industry. And so you get data points which are not sort of echo chambers. You really need to make sure that you're talking to people that are not from your sort of culture of thinking. So you obviously can engage with them and just listen to their perspectives on what you're trying to achieve, how you're going about it, and what your end game is, and sort of let it resonate or be challenged by that sort of source of data. So the big risk is always to sort of go about in your little sort of ivory tower or big ivory tower and build a team around you that all are trying to achieve the same thing without really sort of stripping down the values of what you're trying to achieve to the outcomes. And I think I was very fortunate to build some great teams around me. And we did, some fun and fantastic things. But I always used to sort of make sure that I kind of spend a good amount of time outside that team talking to, either non-bankers or even non-market, just to sort of get them to test my thinking, as it were, to see what I might be missing or what I could, avoid doing. Pitfalls that I would fall in. And I've got some, great people around the world who over the years have been, kind of my sort of think tank. And I rely on that enormously. I think that's, for me, it's been a huge stabilizer. And people that don't hold the punches, they just come very clearly as to what they think about what I'm trying to achieve and how I'm going about it and don't hold back in terms of the challenges that they think I need to hear.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Charles. This was a fascinating conversation. I know we could spend another hour continuing this, so we might invite you to Hidden Growth Champions in future to continue. Thank you for all the insights. Appreciate the time and stay well.
Saab, been a pleasure. Thank you.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.